can. I don't give a damn if it's 9 a.m. My football team's got me drinking. My football team's got me drinking.
You know, like all interesting people, writer Drew McGarry is full of contradiction. So in his nonfiction, which includes sports commentary and political commentary and cultural commentary, he's got kind of a badass Hunter Thompson voice, which I sometimes even find kind of intimidating. It is a lot of profanity and derision, but that's wrapped around a lot of wit and insight. But in his fiction writing, a different voice emerges, particularly in his new novel, The Hike, where we meet a pretty normal guy in his mid-30s, a suburban dad and husband from Maryland who's trapped in a nightmare world. And we also know that Drew McGarry wears cargo shorts, so how badass could he really be? He's joining us now, either to defend or lay down that reputation. Welcome to our conversation, Drew McGarry.
I'm literally wearing cargo shorts.
Out of solidarity for you, dude, I'm wearing cargo shorts. I mean, that's really true. I'm sitting here. I have never worn cargo shorts to work before, but because I want you to know I care, I have them on right now. And so we have to contextualize this. So you were covering the Republican National Convention, now, and it's been blown up into, I think, a somewhat mythical version. I think in the mythical version, you got kicked out of the Republican convention for your cargo pants. But that's not quite true, is it?
No, I went into the media box and the usher pulled me aside and he said, "Did you get the memo?" And I said, "What memo?" And he's like, "There's a dress code now." And I was like, "Oh," I was like, "Long pants, huh?" And he's like, "Long pants. Next time."
Yeah.
So I was like, "All right." So then I showed up the next night in long pants. And that's what happened.
It seems to me that someone coming up to you at the Republican convention in Cleveland and saying, "Did you get the memo?" There are so many things that memo could have been about.
Yeah. And so many memos lost that people really probably didn't get.
And it actually also turned into a little thing among the Women's Press Corps because they were upset. They, in fact, were subjected to a perhaps more stringent and well-spelled-out dress code. And they were chafing under it, right?
Dressed like a proper lady, yeah. Mine was standard. You're dressed like a slob, and perfectly fair to get at me for that. I really didn't have a problem with the policy. I was just hoping I could sneak in and stay cool.
Right. On the other hand, and first of all, we should also say that over at Jezebel, for example, they were strangely heartened by what had happened to you. That made them feel a little bit better about what was happening to them. They were saying if McGarry's cargo shorts are banned, maybe we can live with the yoke that has been placed upon us by an oppressive
rule. Yeah, they turned against me. That's not fair.
Not fair at all. Although, and we'll, let's say one last word about cargo shorts because that's not what we're here to talk about. But you really do like them, right? Because you can put stuff in them.
Yeah, I can put stuff in them, but I don't have to wear pants, and I don't have to carry a bag around. So that's I don't want carrying. I hate carrying things.
Yeah.
But they're hands free.
Yeah, it does. You do get stigmatized, though, and I don't know what your wife is like, but the woman I live with regards anything like that with like a lot of pockets. It goober is the word that she uses to stigmatize it.
That sounds about right. Yeah, it's like dad uniform. But
right.
I have a nice pair on today. I have a pair of Calvin Klein cargo shorts on today. So they're a little more slim fit.
All right, so you're rocking those cargo pants. We have a lot of things we want to talk about today, ranging from politics to culture to sports to cooking. Drew McGarry is a Chopped champion. But I think first we should spend a little time on the real reason he's here, which is The Hike. It's a novel. It's a hard novel to describe. It's about somebody who does seem to get lost in a nightmare, a waking nightmare. He has for company occasionally a wisecracking crab who sounds a lot like the Drew McGarry who writes for Deadspin and GQ. He sounds much more like that Drew McGarry than does the protagonist, Ben. I would say if you like the books of Lev Grossman, who's been on this show a lot, you will probably probably like The Hike. So maybe you can, first of all, I mean, did this arise from, do you go on long hikes and suddenly have moments of anxiety? Like, what if I can't get back? What if the entire landscape changes?
Yeah, it came from a literal hike I took where I was walking outside a hotel and was very alone in the woods, and there was nothing else around. And my imagination started to play tricks on me, and was thinking about, like, you know, bears coming and kidnapping me and stuff like that. So that all came from a real spot. And then also, yeah, if I go somewhere on business and I'm away from my family and kids, I don't really know what to do with myself. So yeah, I will walk around the city, in like a lot. I'll walk a few miles every day to sort of get the lay of the land and just have something to do and get some exercise and stuff like that.
So in this one too, there seems to be a way in which this surreal, fantastic experience is kicking all kinds of psychic tripwires for this guy. For example, he has a problem with Rottweilers. I don't want to do any spoilers, but he's got a Rottweiler issue, and there are people running around in not just Rottweiler masks, but the kind of flayed off skin of Rottweilers chasing him around. Maybe that was a spoiler. I don't know. So,
no, it's all right.
Yeah. Do you have specific phobias when you're out in the woods, like, you know, things that would really be upsetting to you?
There are a couple of my fears in the book. Like I live in Maryland, and there are cave crickets in my basement, and I hate them. So that's in the book. I know people who have been attacked by dogs, and so I'm a little wary of pit bulls and Rottweilers. So so that's in there. Although that's sort of an indirect fear. So yeah, whatever I find sort of repulsive and disgusting, I put in there for sheer entertainment.
I don't live in Maryland, and I had never heard of a cave cricket or imagined a cricket being a source of terror.
You wouldn't think. But yeah, I didn't know about them until we moved here. My parents have actually lived in Connecticut for like 25 years, and they're not up there.
Yeah.
And then they were in my basement. I was like, what are these disgusting things in my basement?
So, I mean, from the book, I know what an encounter with a really, really large one would be like. But what is so bad about they just hop around a lot, though. I mean, that's all they do. I mean,
they hop around. They look really gross, and yeah. They hop at you. And I don't know. I'm a wuss. You're right. They don't bite or sting, and yet I'm scared to death of them.
Do they poop on you? Do they ooze on you? Do they, you know?
Oh yeah. If you kill them, they have like a sick, disgusting ooze that comes out. It's gross.
Well, that's. I think that would be their right if you killed them.
Yeah, that's true.
You can't get
the right to. They have the right to bleed on you.
Right, you can't get upset about what something does when you kill it.
Yeah,
you know?
No, I agree.
You forfeited your right to outrage about this. So I have developed a theory while I was reading this book, which you are now free to shoot down. But I thought I could find a through line to part of your past writing, although I think you tended not to be the one writing these pieces so much for Deadspin. But Deadspin, which we should say for people who are uninitiated, is a very attitudinal sports website. Will Leach, the founder, has been on the show many times. And one of the things they're really interested in are how terrifying many sports mascots are. And there's this whole kind of nightmare fuel theme that runs through Deadspin's reporting on sports mascots. Because why? Because there's something, I mean, they're big things. They're like, you know, human-sized crabs in some cases and ants and weird abstractions. And they have these frozen expressions that don't modulate at all. You know, they're always smiling no matter what's happening, right? I started wondering as I was reading this book, I wonder if sports mascots at some subconscious level had gotten into your head.
No, but I see. I agree about how they can be a little creepy. There's a dude, you know, in a giant with a giant head, and the expression is frozen solid, and it's hard to envision like a person behind it. It just seems like a monster, you know. No, the only thing that I sort of borrowed from my blogging history was I wrote an NFL site called Kissing Susie Colbert, and we used to Photoshop pictures of people and replace their eyes with their mouth. We would do mouth eye stuff. And we would have that under the tag Nightmare Fuel, and it was disgusting. And people were always like, oh, God, why did you have to go do that? And that I had some influence from that.
So another thing that seems to have influenced you is something that I was completely unaware of. I think I'm just generationally not poised for this, something called the King's Quest video game series. I looked it up. It looks like sort of an 8-bit kind of old-style
Yeah, old school, like point and click stuff.
And so, what is it? What is it, and how did it inform the hike?
There are these old shoddy computer games that I played for hours on end, where you were like a dude and you were on a quest, and you had an unlimited inventory. You had to pick like you had to look behind a rock, and there would be a magical dagger, and then you'd have to go, you know, three panels over, and you would have to use the dagger to dig a hole to get the lamp and rub the lamp to have a genie come out and stuff like that. And I don't. For some reason, I was always really drawn to that sort of clumsy, buggy style of gameplay with a little 8-bit dude walking around, and so the book. There's no video game references in the book, but it has that feel at times of sort of found objects and magical potions and all that stuff. Just because I still like that. The kid in me still enjoys all that.
Usually people produce culture, the kind of culture that they want to read and that they've liked in the past. Was there anything in particular that you were trying to do with this, either in terms of capturing some other kind of work that you've enjoyed a lot? Or, I mean, what's your ultimate goal for the hike?
Well, I mean, the goal is to sell a bazillion copies.
Yes, I knew you were going to say that.
God. No, every time I write a book, the only goal is make it as entertaining as possible for the reader. And if they take anything extra away, that's fine. And in terms of my own enjoyment, yeah, I want something that reads fast and has a lot of stuff happen and has a lot of action that sort of comes at you. And is fun and has characters you can connect with. So, and the other thing is that, you know, I read a lot of folktales as I was a kid, and so I kind of wanted to do an update on that and have a story that's pretty durable. I mean, the basic plot of the story is a guy gets lost and has to come home, which is the oldest plot on Earth, you know. But there's a reason that plot, you know, sort of sticks around because it's really durable. So it's nice to sort of aspire to do something that will be close in spirit to Wizard of Oz or It's a Wonderful Life or any of those sort of, you know, any sort of surreal quest type classic story.
Or the Odyssey. And so the Odyssey maybe is the you know, the Rosetta Stone from which a lot of this other stuff depends. And I don't know. I mean, the Odyssey always winds up being also about life stages and life challenges. And I know you're mainly trying to entertain us, but are there things in this book that are very real for you, either spiritual questions, psychological questions, family dynamics
sure.
questions?
Yeah, yeah, no. And I think that goes into entertainment, you know, and that goes into people are going to be more into the story if they're into the character. And so you have to go deep into the character so that they have something they can connect with on a deeper level, you know, loneliness and longing and regret and all of that stuff. That all plays into it. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, and this dialogue between the protagonist and the crab, I mean, it really kind of gets down to the whole question of what's the point, right? What's the point of all this? Is there some big master plan for life, or are we just sort of walking through various stages of our biological existence? Are you conscious of loading that question into this book? Is it something that's kind of gnawing at you right now?
Yeah, I mean, sure. I wonder what the point is sometimes, you know, if I'm having a bad day. I mean, generally I have a pretty good outlook, but, you know, I wonder about what's in the beyond. I wonder what's in charge of all this, you know. I'm not like a specifically religious guy, but there's something that's keeping the electrons spinning, and I'm in awe of the power, but I don't quite know what it is, you know.
We're talking to Drew McGarry right now. He's a correspondent for GQ and a columnist for Deadspin. He's the author of the memoir, Someone Could Get Hurt, and the novel Postmortal. But right now he's got a book out called The Hike. It's a novel, as we're saying. He's also a 2015 Chopped champion. I guess we'll get to that at some point. I do want to talk a little bit about some of the work that you've been doing for GQ and talking about whether we're, in fact, in the middle of somebody's master plan. Here in 2016, I think a lot of us have felt like, well, if we're in the middle of somebody's master plan, he has a really fiendish sense of humor.
And so
maybe we can begin a little bit with the Republican convention. What did you encounter there? Reading your coverage for GQ from the Republican convention, I kind of sensed that you both were and were not meeting the kind of Trumpian world that your imagination had conjured up.
Well, we thought it would be a very chaotic scene, and there would be a lot of social upheaval and unrest. That's why we went. I wasn't hoping for that. I don't want anyone to get hurt. You know, I don't want Cleveland to burn or anything like that. You know, and when we went, it was very muted. It was very staid. You know, a lot of the delegates that were there didn't want to be there. They weren't terribly enthusiastic. So a lot of the sort of party atmosphere wasn't there. And then in terms of protesters, there were a few, but, you know, frankly, you know, protesters, they're not just gonna go to Cleveland, you know, like if it had been Los Angeles, then, you know, they could have done something cool with their off protesting hours. But like, it just wasn't, it wasn't heavily populated. It was mostly cops and media people, and then, like, you know, some delegates, and that was kind of it.
So one of the things that I found, I've only covered one Trump rally so far, but I've always thought that one of the that what's terrifying sometimes is when the veil of comity, of politeness, of geniality is pierced. Like, I think Rosemary's Baby is a really scary movie, specifically because at a certain point, Mia Farrow has to acknowledge that all these really nice people, John Cassavetes and Ruth Gordon, and the people who've been smiling at her and acting really nice towards her, they're demons. You know, they're really right. Horrible people. And there's going to be, at minimum, this very socially awkward moment where that has to be talked about. And I find that more scary than anything visceral that might happen.
Well,
go ahead.
That was the problem with the RNC, or not the problem with the reason that the RNC was a relatively peaceful affair was because, unlike a Trump rally, which are now, they're really distilled into a specific sort of angry goober, and those rallies are populated exclusively by his people, you know, so they're going to be more chaotic. Whereas this, you know, you had establishment Republicans, you had Cruz supporters, you had delegates who were obligated to who were allocated to Trump, didn't really want to vote for him, but were party loyalists and were going to. So it's almost like a music festival where, you know, people were there to see a lot of bands, but not necessarily just one. And so, you know, it's hard to sort of it's hard for that group to coalesce and start making some mayhem the way it is at a Trump rally where it's really now just sort of one sort of angry type of person.
I love the idea that it's a music festival, like the worst music festival ever. Oh, I hope Ted Cruz plays his hits. Let him play his hits.
Yeah.
But what I found at the rallies was that I would talk to people at the rallies, and they were often very nice people, you know, and they were guys who had, they were auto body shop guys or whatever. They had small businesses, and I said who I was, and we smiled at each other, and we were nice. I asked them a lot of questions. They were happy to be asked questions. And then Trump came on, and he started to do his thing. And at a certain point in his more or less canned patter, he points at the area, that pen where they keep the press, points at us and goes, "These are the worst people in the world," and everybody starts booing, including these really nice guys that I've been talking to a couple of seconds ago.
Suddenly they're foaming in the mouth and possessed by a demon,
And so, but that makes me wonder, what's the reality? To me, that part felt like kabuki, and the thing that had happened before that, the conversation with those guys, felt real. I mean, it kind of made me wonder, are both things equally real? What should I put my trust in?
Yeah, I think he's exploiting a lot of inner angst and anger that people have and blame, you know, blame on foreign groups or anybody else that they think has an outside force that has conspired to make their lives miserable. And so face to face they'll be pleasant, but when they get worked up over, you know, it's, you know, that, but then you open up a can of worms in front of them and they feel I think probably liberated by Trump's, you know, sort of officiousness, that they can act likewise.
Do you feel as though in covering this campaign that it's such a fire hose, stuff is just spraying out all the time, that you almost don't get a chance to linger over things? I mean, there was a moment after Cruz's speech where he said, I think the next day, that he didn't want to be anybody's servile little puppy.
Right.
Which now we know what his safety word is. But also, I mean, that was the kind of thing that I would have savored for a little while, except that, I mean, there's stuff happening so fast that things that might have been interesting to deal with, you can't really stay with them very long.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? I mean, like, remember when he threatened the Pope and, like, and he said Putin called Obama the N-word? Like, that wasn't even the lead story of the day, you know?
One thing does kind of drive out another. So, you know, we just sort of back to what Cleveland was like. My sense watching it on television, I've covered a lot of conventions, I didn't cover this one, was that I mean, not only wasn't Cleveland burning, and I agree nobody wants Cleveland to burn, but that, I don't know, the energy level just in general all over the place didn't seem like maybe even in the hall didn't seem like what I would have expected.
Yeah, when the first night in the hall, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, it was very wan, and it got more enthusiastic night by night, but that was because I think a lot of people who were obligated to be in the hall didn't have to go those later nights and were replaced by people more supportive of Trump's cause. But in the initial sort of formal stages of the convention, when a lot of people were not enthusiastic to be there, then the crowd was, you know, instead of people voicing their displeasure, it was more sort of a resignation and you know, tepid enthusiasm.
One of the things that he's doing a lot is, and he was doing a lot at that convention, is showcasing his family. Although that's kind of turning into a thing, too. I mean, remember the good old days when you had to go find somebody to nominate you for president whom you didn't toilet train and put through college?
Right.
I mean, it's like now everybody's doing that.
He didn't toilet train those kids.
That's probably true. Although whoever toilet trained Eric and Donald, there's still some resentment left over, I think.
It's one of the bad media things is that where they're like, oh well, he sucks, but his kids are lovely, and the kids have said some rotten stuff, you know. So it's like, no, you don't get a free pass just because the people around you are slightly less objectionable than you are. That's not how that works.
No, and somebody compared Donald Jr. and Eric to kind of the scary guys in like a John Hughes high school movie. You know,
right,
they would be the guys who are really being really mean to Molly Ringwald.
Yeah, with the Patrick Bateman hair and all that.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
And they also go to Africa and shoot leopards and stuff and stand on top of them.
So it's like, you know, just by staying next to Donald Trump, you automatically look like a better person, but it doesn't mean you are.
But I have to say, just in the interest of fairness, that I found Chelsea to be an inappropriate person to handle the intro for her mom. That they, you know, first of all, it went on way too long. It was paced in a very strange way. And I just sort of thought, it seems to me that it wasn't that long ago where, you know, you had to find somebody else who'd done something like this to nominate you as opposed to somebody who has no choice but to love and approve of you.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. I think that political families are now so visible and sort of part of the process that I think it's less a comment on the politician than their stagecraft, where they have people who love them unconditionally, and you know they know they can get an aw moment, you know, instead of having a colleague do it, and there's some warmth and humanity, and that's all very strategic.
Yeah. So, but it's like we're Argentina with the Perones or something. It's just like we now get families. We get dynasties. We don't get.
Yeah, you get dynasties, man.
Yeah. All right. We're talking to Drew McGarry right now. We're going to take a little break here. His newest book is The Hike. It is a novel. It veers into the world of disturbing fantasy, but it's also kind of funny. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more Drew after this.
You said your favorite color was green.
So guess what?
Donald Trump black version. Maybe that's what you need. A man that fulfills your every wish, your every dream. Donald Trump black version.
We're talking to Drew McGarry. He's a correspondent for GQ, a columnist for Deadspin, the author of the memoir Someone Could Get Hurt, that's about being a parent, and the novel The Postmortal. Most recently, currently, The Hike is out. It's a novel about a man who gets lost in the woods, like really lost in the woods, and not just the woods. I want to talk to you about a bunch of different things here, but and maybe that's a good way to begin, which is that you, like a lot of people these days, I think, don't necessarily observe the divisions that journalists used to have to observe. There used to be people who wrote about sports and people who wrote about politics and people who wrote about culture. Somehow over the last 10 or 20 years, we've started to believe and understand the amount of intersection among those things that, you know, and some of the brands that you've been associated with seem to say that too, that, you know, people aren't just interested in one thing, so why should a writer write about one thing? You want to react to that?
So I'm talking about like just writing different stuff?
Yeah, just the notion. I mean, there used to be people who were sports writers, and sports writers, they wrote about sports, and that's what they wrote about, and they didn't write about anything else.
All those barriers are breaking down, and it's part of the economy because, you know, a lot of the media companies are strictly freelance-based now, and so people have to write where they can, and, you know, I am of the mind that, I tend to be a multitasker because it helps me. If I get stuck on one thing, I just move to another project. I think it keeps you sharp and flexible to do different stuff. You do a little bit of sports, a little bit of politics, a little bit of entertainment. And some writers don't work that way. Some writers want to do one thing and one thing only, and I respect that. But for me personally, it's, it's much better for my career prospects if I can do a little bit of everything.
I think also it's the way that we think. I think we understand things culturally. I mean, I think, what did I just say, that the two Trump kids were like villains in a John Hughes movie? I mean, I think that in many ways, the way that we process political reality is through the culture that we understand.
Yeah, and my sort of, my brain now operates the way it does when I'm surfing the internet, where I have five tabs open and I dabble a little here and a little bit there, and your Twitter feed is completely schizophrenic because it's jokes, but then it's also horrible news and stupid GIFs and then terrifying videos from like some country in upheaval or something like that, and I think it's sort of wired my brain where I have a bit of a short attention span, but I'm able, it's sort of like diffuse focus, It's not, I don't feel like it's detrimental to me, but I definitely feel a sort of a jumping around.
I think also, Reagan got in trouble because sometimes it seemed as though he didn't know that he was talking about one of his old movies when he was talking about something in real life, that he had somehow or other fused policy with the popular culture out of which he had emerged. But I think now we're kind of all doing that. And I think, if you're a politician, you run the risk of kind of exciting people's memories of some popular culture that preceded you. I'll give you an example. Trump has this thing where he says that, and he's been saying it all along through this campaign, that he's a great deal maker. So in foreign policy, he would just go make deals, whoever
right.
it is. He'd make a deal. He'd make an arrangement. And I may have mentioned this on the radio before, but I keep thinking about Hart Bochner as Ellis in Die Hard. Because, right, isn't that what he says to Bonnie Bedelia? This is what I do. I make deals. I'll just go make a deal. I'll make a deal with the terrorists.
They get shot in the face.
And it's almost as if you're a candidate now and you say something, there's a pretty good chance that people who are basically are imbued with all kinds of popular culture references are going to go, oh, no, you're just like that guy in that movie.
Yeah, sure. And, it's actually the danger in books, because if I do it online, like there's a certain disposability online where you can make pop culture references and it's fine because the blog post is going to have a shelf life of like 2 days anyway. With some small exceptions, but a book you really have to build to last. So if you're going to make a pop culture reference, you need to make sure that it's still relevant, 10, 20 years from now. Otherwise it's not going to, because of the lag time involved, you don't want it to be dated instantly.
Drew McGarry, as I said at the beginning of this conversation, you do have this kind of voice that you write in, and it occasionally does remind me of Hunter Thompson, minus the really hard drugs. But there's also this other side of you. And reading your novel, The Hike, I feel like this protagonist, Ben, who basically loves his wife and loves his kids and misses home, and, that's probably a little bit closer to who I would know if I just was one of your friends from high school or college, the person that I would know, than this guy who's so good at ripping stuff to shreds. Or are both of those aspects of you very present and real?
Yeah, I think they're both fairly real. I mean, I like goofing off and complaining, like taking small annoyances and then blowing them out to extremes just for comic effect, like in real life too, But I think you can sort of occupy both those personas, and it's like anybody else. You have I'm probably even less complex than most people, I get worked up about stuff like anybody else, but then at the end of it I'm still just a basic generic dad, like living in the suburbs and all that. And I think one of the reasons that I've been able to, sort of do rants and stuff like that and have them go over pretty well is when you do that stuff, there has to be something that signals to the reader that you have a sort of moral center of your own, that you're choosing your targets wisely, you're willing to also make fun of yourself, and that you are, when when matters get serious, you do take things seriously and stuff like that. So I think if you give that the reader that sort of faith in the person behind the writing, then it, you have license to do a lot more.
Right. That's a great way of putting it. It leads me to – I have two sets of questions about this. One of them is, so you're a loving father, but not a loving enough father to buy your child a Trump whoopee cushion, even though you knew it would make her really happy. I think you should have to explain on the air why your daughter is growing up in America without a Trump whoopee cushion.
Because it was $10. It's overpriced. You can get a regular whoopee cushion for $1. It's a dollar store. That it was way, the markup was – it was too much. It wouldn't have been right, you know?
Also, you said, I think in the piece, that you don't like blowing into them.
Yeah, because they're all powdery and they smell weird and all that.
All right.
It's like blowing up like a pig's bladder.
Well, you know, in the same piece that I'm talking about, which is about sort of this kind of hate paraphernalia that was available and other kinds of enjoyable, life-affirming paraphernalia, like whoopee cushions, that was available at the convention, some of the stuff that you described is stuff that I've seen, too. And it's a lot of it is stuff that caricatures Hillary Clinton in, the most vulgar terms possible, the most bodily terms possible. There's this whole KFC joke about her, which I'm not even going to repeat on the air. You found a motorcycle thing where Trump's wearing a T-shirt that says, if you can read that, this, it means the bitch fell off, and you can sort of see Hillary Clinton falling off a motorcycle. And, in some ways, to your point before about the idea that maybe you're a guy who comes across as kind of sardonic and profane, but there's some kind of moral center there. I was intrigued to see that your moral center was actually truly offended by some of the stuff that you were looking at.
Oh, yeah, sure. I think that's part of it. I think, if you're going to do a rant, well, you should punch up, right? You should, punch up at Roger Goodell or someone who has a bit more authority and power than you do, as opposed to just selectively belittling people, for reasons that are small and petty,
Roger Goodell is actually a very sensitive guy.
It would appear.
All right. So we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with more Drew McGarry, one final segment after this.
Pants. What great stuff. Just like pants. Said they got a lot of pockets. What you gonna do if you got a lot of stuff and you don't have a bag and you don't want to hold all of it? How about you get some cargo pants? Those things are so great. They've got a whole lot of pockets.
All right, we're back. It's time for me to say my thank yous. Betsy Kaplan is the master producer of the show. The technical producer is Jonathan McNichol. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin. So if you're hearing this and you want to tweet back, tweet at WNPR Colin. We also have a Facebook page, Colin McEnroe Show on Facebook. And the part of Bill Curry was played by Roger Goodell. We're going to be back tomorrow with The Scramble. We're going to do one of our sort of real-time news reaction shows. I'm assuming some of the things we're talking about today will be part of the fodder of tomorrow's show. This campaign thing, it just seems to gin up an awful lot of news, as we were saying before. Right now, we're talking to Drew McGarry. I have to say, my mind is all screwed up here because I'm going to tell you, we're pre-recording this interview, and we're doing it a few days before it's going to air, and we're also doing it an hour and 30 minutes exactly before it would air. And I'm just – my poor brain is just not handling this all that well. But go ahead,
Pretending one time is another can throw you off a bit.
So hard. So much harder than it should be anyway. Drew McGarry is with us, correspondent for GQ, columnist for Deadspin, author of the memoir Someone Could Get Hurt, the novel The Postmortal, and now The Hike, which is a novel about a man who goes out for a walk in the woods. What he thinks is going to be a very short walk in the woods. But it's not. It's like Gilligan's Island, but with monsters and horrible, frightening things. It's also very funny, too. So, I want to just go back one more time to Cleveland, just because it kind of reunited you with a family whose destinies you have affected, and that would be the Robertson family, the Duck Dynasty people. I know one of them was up on stage, and you're the guy. You wrote the GQ article that really did get Phil Robertson in a lot of trouble. Is that something? I mean, you seem like a nice guy who's not really out there to make a lot of trouble for most of the people that you write about. Do you have any kind of sinking feeling about how that all played out?
I mean, in some ways, yes. I don't have any regrets about the article. The article is perfectly fair. I enjoyed my time with the Robertsons, you know. So it sucks that you have a nice time with someone and then you walk away, and you write your article, and you know, 2 months, you know, 2 months later, everything goes completely crazy and haywire, and you've had this sort of, you know, at least in their mind, a deleterious effect on how they do business. And I don't, you know, I don't like upsetting people or anything like that. But also, I had my job to do, and you know, and I, you know, and he said some controversial stuff, and you know, and they never disagreed with it when it came out. So there's only so much I can do, you know. They're not going to invite me to any garden parties, but that's the deal sometimes with being a journalist. You're going to write stuff that people aren't necessarily going to like, but ultimately, you know, your job is not to serve them, but to serve the reader.
See, I think it's also, not to torture my own analogy, but we're kind of back with the Rosemary's Baby problem, which is that you often encounter in life people who are engaging and nice and pleasant, and if you're visiting them, they show you hospitality, and there's just, you know, some nice, pleasant, cordial bond that you're forging with them, and suddenly they'll say stuff that so completely contravenes your own value system and so completely violates everything that they should be saying to somebody they know is also composing a piece of journalism about them. But, you know, I mean, that's almost secondary. It's the first thing. It's like, wow, you thought it was okay to say that to me? What kind of understanding do you think we have about each other? And I don't know about you, but I often find that just very, very disconcerting. Like, this incredibly pleasant person has suddenly opened up his or her mouth and turned out to be the devil.
Well, it's like seeing your relatives post on Facebook for the first time, you know? And, you know, there's something to be said for sort of forced, phony politeness, you know, where you're face-to-face, you're pleasant, and you don't, you know, you don't just automatically start throwing rhetoric at one another. I mean, there's a superficiality to it that is both, you know, that's kind of necessary and fine, you know, and that's how people are able to live with one another. And I'm all supporting that sort of waspy passive aggression.
Well, there's the whole Janet Malcolm thing where, you know, you're a thief in the night, you're a burglar, you're trying to get somebody to really tell you who they are, which is sometimes the case when you do that kind of thing. But there are other times, other pieces, you know, in a situation like that when you're kind of hoping, well, I hope that's not who you are. And then they tell you it is.
Well, with that stuff, because GQ will sends me to a lot of you know, I did that. I did Kid Rock's cruise. You know, I went to a Trump rally, and we always go into it like agenda free. Like, we can't just go and sneer at people, right? Mm-hmm. That would suck. Then you're just the uppity jerk, going to point at the poor white people and laughing. And that's not really good. No one's gonna want to read that. So you have to be willing to not only empathize with people, but allow yourself to be surprised by them, for better and for worse, you know? And the other thing is that, you know, the internet gets very reductive. So if one person says one ugly thing, that tends to define them, you know? Whereas I think that's obviously not true of people in general, where they might say some ugly things, but they do some good things too. And so there's, you know, a little bit of a yin and a yang. I mean, that's what they're trying to say about Trump now, but that's actually not true. But, like, you know, it's hard to reduce, you know, a person to one soundbite or something like that. And so I really do my best to paint the picture as broadly and as, you know, as with as much detail as I can. And so, you know, hopefully there's stuff that you discovered that you didn't know before that maybe surprises you for good, and then stuff that maybe you suspected was there, and then you have your worst fears confirmed.
Drew McGarry, you talked before about multitasking, about working on different things. If one of them's not pleasing you, you can just jump over to another one. So one of the things that you're working on right now, I mean, maybe not during this conversation, but generally speaking, is our series of pieces in Deadspin called Why Your Favorite Team Sucks. And these are football pieces. I'll let you explain this. This is a subgenre which you've invented and perfected. Explain what it is.
Every year we preview each NFL team going up to the season by explaining why that team sucks. And then all the readers, all the fans of that team chime in to pile on their own team and explain why they're so awful and why they're so annoying. And it's sort of like a little cathartic purge before the season begins so that you are emotionally ready for your team to let you down.
And so, and one of the things that you do in the series is, I mean, it could seem assaultive if we're just you, Drew, pulling up all this stuff, churning up all this stuff that's objectionable and stupid, or the people who've been hired who aren't smart or dumb coaches or whatever. But you end it with this kind of almost oral history of despair for each team, right? One of the things that you do is find quotes from fans talking essentially about all the ways in which they feel very defeated by the level at which their team sucks.
Yeah, it's a cleansing exercise. You air your grievances, and then you feel cleansed.
Now, you and I are on a thin edge here because I'm a Packers fan and you're a Vikings fan.
No, that's all right. I won't hold it against you.
That's not what Obama said when he was on the show. I told him I was a Packers fan, and he's a Bears fan, obviously, and he said, if I'd known that, I wouldn't have agreed to do this show. So you're being much more charitable and open-minded about this than
president. Yeah, I should be president. There you go.
Definitely should be president. So do you do a why your team sucks about the Vikings, or do they get
a pass?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's always the longest one. I got to get off my chest about that team every year.
And are there people who really can't handle this, that they really do regard it as trolling them?
Oh, yeah, there are people who take offense, although it's lessened as years go by, because obviously the first time it happened, people were like, hey, you know. But it's become such a staple of the site and such a yearly sort of event that it doesn't get the mass sort of backlash that it does sometimes. It will vary sometimes team by team, year by year, too.
And this feels like something that you're kind of expanding as a franchise, right? There are why other favorite things suck, right?
Well, like kid TV shows and stuff. Yeah, sure. Although, you know, I have to be flexible, and I have to like some stuff too to balance it out.
Yeah, but I feel as though that's a universe that could expand infinitely.
Oh, sure. Yeah, because there are a lot of things that suck.
Right. The only ceiling really is the amount of time that you have available. Hey, since I know that this is a subject that gives you great pleasure just from your tone of voice when it came up earlier, and also because it's weird because there's people who know you in different ways and know you for different things. You are a Chopped champion. And this was explain how this happened. This was like a thing that they did for people who weren't professional master chefs, right?
Yeah, it was the amateur episode. So I filled out the application and put it up on Deadspin, and then people read it, and then it got to the producers, and that's how I got on the show.
But then you were good enough to win?
And then I was good enough to win, baby.
Well, tell us more. I don't watch Chopped, so tell us, what did that involve?
All right, so Chopped is three courses, appetizer, entree, and dessert, four contestants. One person gets eliminated with each course. And you have to cook whatever's in a mystery basket that you open up, and then you have like 20, 30 minutes to cook the course. And the first basket had like some sausage in it, and the second one had a wild boar roast in it, and I had to make wild boar. And then the last one had like some cottage cheese and like strawberry jam and stuff like that.
And I read your application. One of the things that you seem to have done very effectively is identify things that probably the people who make this TV series don't like about some of the other people who compete, you know, that they whine when they open up and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. They whine and they're like, oh, I don't like that food. Well, why'd you go on the show, you know?
And you are a very serious cook, right? Or an intense cook. What's the right way to put it?
Yeah, I like it. I like it, and I'm annoying when I cook sometimes because I'm into my salad, and I don't want to be disturbed until it's finished and perfect for the family.
Yeah, I'm a little bit like that too. Other people in the kitchen are not necessarily a great thing. You get in a zone, right? You start and you're thinking about what you're thinking about, and you don't want to be thinking about something that somebody comes in and brings up with you. So who did you beat? Who did you crush? When you won Chopped?
I was going up against a cabaret singer, a Long Island hairdresser, and a woman who made life-size dolls. So I beat them.
All right. And like everything else, you have very strong opinions about food. And I have to say, I don't agree, although I agree with most of what you have to say about pasta, I don't agree with you about linguine. Now, explain what your thinking is about linguine.
What did I say about linguine that I didn't like? It always falls off my fork. I think that's my main beef with linguine.
But there's lots of things that fall off your fork. Spaghetti falls off your fork. Angel hair.
Yeah, but something about that flat pattern fits right into the tines of the fork and then slithers right out. I can't keep linguine on my fork for very long.
See, I think the good thing about linguine is because it's flatter than, I mean, spaghetti and angel hair and stuff like that, it's all essentially tubular. But because linguine is flatter, pesto is going to sit on it a little bit more. You know, it's you can't sit on something that's curved, a curved surface like spaghetti. So,
no, it's true. It's true.
Yeah.
And it has its place. Like, I like it in Fra Diablo and stuff like that. So I'm not fully, I don't push it away in disgust. Like, right. I find it impractical sometimes.
Right. Well, I mean, I just wanted to clear that up because, first of all, I mean, as you know better than I do, although I have this experience a lot, everything offends somebody. Everything that you ever say is offensive to at least some small group of people. I'm sure there's some kind of linguine support group out there. That's,
linguine rights activists.
Yeah,
sure.
Exactly. And they're going to come talk to you. So as we're kind of running out of time here, but just another dimension of all this, I mean, here you are, this winner of Chopped. You're also a guy who lost a lot of weight, right?
Yeah, like 2010, like I dropped like 60, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just I stopped eating late. And I, you know, I kept track of calories finally for the, you know, the way human beings are supposed to, and that helped.
Did you have a personality that was based on the kind of body that you had when you had 60 more pounds on it? Did you have to decide whether to keep that personality?
No, I think it's only the only difference is this, you know, the sort of the basic mood enhancer. You feel better, you know, you're fit. You feel better about yourself. You feel better about your health. You have a better outlook. That's really the standard difference. You feel better about yourself, and that affects, you know, that radiates out.
Hmm. So for somebody who multitasks as much as you do, what's next is probably a kind of a tricky question. But I assume, first of all, what's next for you right now is spending from here to November covering this campaign a lot. But do you have other big projects up out on the horizon?
No, for now, no, because I tend to write books in the NFL offseason, and we're just getting to the start of it. So that's going to occupy a lot of the bulk of my time. And you know, and I'm not in a rush. Like, this book came along because, you know, I had tried to rush a couple of other books, and then this one happened naturally. So I'm going to try and just sort of take it as it comes this time.
What subplots of the NFL season are you intrigued by? And don't say Tom Brady. We're all tired of Tom Brady.
I just want to watch my team, the Vikings, and see how they're going to destroy my will to live.
They are definitely going to do that. Well, Drew McGarry, it's been terrific to talk to you. The book, we should say, is The Hike. It is a novel. It's about, as we say, a man who gets lost in the woods is befriended by a crab who talks a lot like the way Drew McGarry writes when he's writing about sports and politics. It's both funny and upsetting, and when you get up from reading it, you have to feel around your house to make sure your own reality is still intact. Thanks for doing this with us today.
Thanks a million, man.
Well, there's crackers in the stew. Spuds are gone black. Chicken's gone off and he ain't coming back. What's cooking? Tell me, baby. In your kitchen. You got a hell of a mix. A load of base in your kitchen. I said, well, the eggs are broken. Burn the fries, some in the fridge. You can't recognize what's cooking in your kitchen. You got a hell of a mess all over the place in your kitchen.